I'm Al Pitcher, and I welcome this opportunity to talk with you a little about energy. We'll be talking about it again on Thursday and on Saturday, same time. It's a little preposterous to talk about this subject in such a short period of time, and it's a little preposterous for me to talk about it, since I'm just a kind of ordinary lay person that started attending to energy a few years ago. And I always find in every group I've ever talked with, people who know a lot more about something that I'm talking about than I do. And that's kind of the way I learned. One of the first years I talked about up here, I remember I was talking about nuclear, and the guy who's in charge of energy safety for one of the biggest construction companies for nuclear plants was in the audience. So he promptly sat me down for 3 hours and lectured me on what they did for safety and all the problems, and he knew all the pros and cons. My conviction, however, is that the way to avoid making the gospel real is to stay in the realm of generality, and that therefore we have to attend to something very concretely. And we can't attend to many things, so that we have to pick out something in order to know what the meaning of the gospel is. And I picked out the civil rights movement for a long time and attended to it, and then I decided on energy as a way to attend to something and see what faith means very concretely. And it's a very difficult task to know what faith means in the concrete. It's much easier to stay up in the air and preach sermons and talk about faith in general. So our church, which is a small church on the edge of the University of Chicago, started several years ago with an adult class. And we had, I think, 9 sessions with about 30 people in each session. And after that, we established a task force on energy. And in the meantime, of course, I was teaching some courses in the Divinity School at the university and teaching on energy, since that's the way I was learning about it. And then we developed some relations, and I became a consultant for the American Baptists when they wrote their national program on energy. And we took the program they wrote and went back into our church task force, our church board. We discussed the general statement, and then that became the policy statement for the Disciples of Christ, and which was passed by Disciples of Christ. I don't think much came of it, but I'm just telling you the kind of process that was involved. I began to attend to energy, and I began to get our church to attend to energy, and I began to get a few people in our church to attend to energy. So when that policy statement came through our church, most of the people on the board had read some white papers that we had issued and were prepared to deal with it in some way a little bit sophisticated. Then the National Council developed a task force on energy, an advisory board, which the disciples put me on, since I was one of the most informed, since I'd started to attend to energy. Now, I'm just kind of illustrating how I got into this thing and what happened. And so I was in long sessions on that, and then the Presbyterians are developing a book on energy, and I was just down at Ghost Ranch for a week when 35 of us spent a whole week together on energy. Well, that's kind of what I come out of, a kind of ordinary layperson with some extraordinary responsibilities and opportunities in terms of using my teaching, tending to energy and going to meetings and listening to people and talking, and I've spent quite a bit of time in conferences where the technologists, where the technical people talk, so that I can learn something from them. So the first assumption I have is that in the Christian faith we have a kind of dialectic between two poles, the Christian faith and the energy situation. And there are a great deal, are many problems and many differences of opinion, both about the Christian faith and about what the actual energy situation is. Now, I just want to say a few words about my assumptions about the Christian faith. We could spend, weeks on this, too. But I don't start simply from the point of view either of the Christian faith or the energy situation. I'm trying to bring these two worlds together. But I am convinced, or I believe, or I feel with my whole being that God created the world of nature and of human nature, and that all human and non-human reality has a place in God's economy, in his world. And nothing is created simply for our use in our own way. There's nothing in creation which hasn't some intent in God's way, in God's world, and we use it responsibly only when we try to see it from the point of view of the whole creation. Everything has meaning in the context of the whole. And so we have to look at what we do and how we use things in the context of the whole of creation. And everything has what I call intrinsic meaning. That is, it has a meaning in and of itself. A stone has a meaning in and of itself. A clod of earth. Nothing is simply instrumental for our use. This is very difficult for us, and we've interpreted Genesis to mean that everything was created simply for our use. It's a very mysterious, it's a very sticky kind of a concept, but I have a sacramental view of nature, which means that there is ultimacy in nature as well as in human nature. So that you can never use animal life, according to Albert Schweitzer, because somehow it had an intrinsic meaning. But he had to live on vegetable life. Now, there's no way for us to live apart from using other life. Now, it may be, of course, that we can finally get chemicals and we won't have to use any life. So it's very ambiguous. You can't simply say that you can avoid using other life for your purpose. So I'm not trying to suggest it's simple. The second assumption is that the whole world is interrelated. We belong to each other. And I really come out of 1 Corinthians 12, where if a man who's in our church dies and is alone in his room and nobody even knows it, I die too. And if somebody has a joyful experience, then I rejoice that we are parts of each other. And I firmly believe it. It's very difficult to rationalize this, to make it kind of sensible in our world. We think we're kind of atomized individuals, but I firmly believe, and I think the Christian faith asserts, that we belong to each other. We are parts of each other, and if anything happens to one, it happens to all. That's simply a very strong conviction, and I know I kind of overdo it, and many of my friends that I'm trying to get in our covenantal community say, well, you move way over on the side of the community and the belongingness, and you really leave the individual out. Well, I don't think that I leave the individual out, but in the light of the way in which we've become individualized, it may, I think you can afford almost to forget about the individual. Now, it's clear that there are no merely technical ways to deal with energy, to me at least. You cannot turn the issues over to the technicians. It's a very complex issue. There are very complex technical issues, but every technical issue is also a moral, political, and religious issue. So what I want to do now is to talk about energy as a moral, political, and religious issue. Actually, I'm engaged in trying to finish a small paper that I've agreed to write for the Presbyterians, and the Presbyterians have picked it apart, and I've tried to kind of rewrite it for you. So you can pick it apart, and maybe by the time it's through, it'll be maybe it'll be worse, but I hope it'll be better. So in the United States, we use the wrong kind of energy. We use energy in the wrong way. And we make our decisions about energy economically and politically in the wrong way. Sounds a little pessimistic. In other words, we act immorally or unethically in relation to energy. The use of energy is a moral issue. Now, in the second place, we use Well, we've organized our energy issue in such, or our energy industry in such a way that it's very difficult for us to have a democratic politics. The organization of the energy industry follows the organization of our economic and political life generally, so that the issues are so complex that most of us can't understand them, and if we did understand them and have a policy, we would not have the power with which to do very much about them. Also, we use too much energy. Underlying the moral and political issue is a religious issue. Our way of life, our way of being, is such that too much energy is required. Thus, I say we might change our actions so as to use renewable sources of energy more and more, that is, use the right kind of energy, use our energy efficiently, use it in the right way, organize ourselves so as to make our decisions about energy such that our economic life was responsible to the polity for embodying the common good, and the polity functioned with a view to the good for all persons, so that we changed our economic and political way of making decisions. And we could change the energy producing system. All of that without dealing with what I think is the fundamental issue that's at stake, that is the religious issue. If the reigning notion of human fulfillment that informs our present vision of the common good is not different, we will not have dealt with the energy issue completely. We would not have dealt with what I consider to be the underlying issue, namely that we use so much energy in part because our way of life is idolatrous. Since our way of life is not fulfilling, we use a great deal of energy in the effort to find fulfillment, to find some way of finding meaning. So that our high use of energy, I say, is in part a response to our failure to find an adequate meaning in life. One could almost say that our way of life is organized in such a way as to use energy, and sometimes I feel that it is. Sometimes I feel that the forces, not because any particular individual decides it, but the forces of our economic and political system are such that they require us to use energy, and they function in order to develop energy systems. And you can see this if you take, for example, just to illustrate it, our transportation system. Well, we developed a transportation system and a residential pattern of living which simply requires energy. And it's very difficult to develop other systems of transportation that would require less energy. And you think almost that the system is built in and just kind of generates more and more energy using mechanisms and institutions. Well, let me then take up each one of these issues separately. I'm now dealing with energy as a moral issue, and the first concern is that we use the wrong kind of energy.
Under your chair.
Under my chair. I knew I'd lost a page. Be terrible. I wouldn't know what to say. We use the wrong kind of energy. If we believed that the resources of the earth are a part of the creation, gifts of God for all life, human and otherwise, we would use resources so that all life, present and future, had access to needed resources, and so that threats to life from the polluting effects of the use of resources were minimized. Thus, we would use non-renewable energy sources sparingly and concentrate on the use of resources that were renewable. Only with extreme caution would we use energy sources that produce gases, particles, radiation, and heat, excesses of which threaten the survival of life. We would use gas, oil, coal, and fission and fusion sources, which leave radioactive residues or contaminated materials less and less or not at all. We would use sun, wind, and water more and more. And I have a statement in here. One of the ways to use the sun, now almost completely neglected, would be to grow organic material and convert it to alcohol or gas, which they're doing in many parts of the world. Brazil, for example, is running its cars now on alcohol, and we know that we can use our car. But there is a problem with this, I'm told. I thought the cycle was rather complete, but down in New Mexico, somebody said, several somebodies, that if you grow plants and you convert plants into methane or alcohol, the plants use in the growing, in the photosynthesis, less carbon dioxide than they give off. I don't know whether that's right or not. I don't know the technical, and I haven't been able to find any. But if that is so, then part of my whole program, which was to develop biomass, you see how the technical and the moral are intertwined, part of my whole program, which is to grow trees and kelp in the Pacific Ocean and use water lilies and all kinds of stuff that are available and put land into growth that's now used for nothing, where we could do some of this, all that is problematic. So it requires kind of a rethinking of my program in part on the basis of the technical problem of how much carbon dioxide is given off that is not used in the growing of the plants. You know, it was a perfect thing I thought I had, that if the plants grow, they use the carbon dioxide which is going off, which is given off when you use it as energy, and then you've got a nice cycle, and you don't give that carbon dioxide pollution that people are worried about for fear it will create a blanket around the earth and cool it off so that New York City, you know, slips into the ocean and other things. Even if our use of fossil fuels, in our use of fossil fuels, we somehow decide to use what is in shortest reserve. Now, I'm still saying we use the wrong kind of energy. First was we should use renewable sources. Second is that even in the use of our fossil fuels, we use the wrong kind of fossil fuels. That is, we're using up our oil and our gas, which are in short supply, when we could be using our coal. Now, there are all kinds of problems in using the coal, both in the mining and the burning. But the Swedes, I read several places, have developed a fluidized bed process of burning coal, which gives off practically no pollution. Actually, somebody said that the British used this years and years ago. It's a kind of a pressurized system where the coal is in small particles are kind of blown up and mixed with some substances which take off the sulfur and other things, so that we could, with technological means, burn the coal without all the problems that we're having if we decided to. With all the problems of producing and using coal, many of which at least could be met partially by the introduction of new technology, it makes more sense to use coal rather than oil and gas. The ratios of use to reserve, I say, are 1 to 56 for oil, 1 to 23 for gas, and 1 to 2500 for coal. That is the amount used compared with known reserves. And those figures, you know, go up and down, and it's anybody's guess. I've just read figures after figures after figures and make some kind of estimate of how much reserve is a fairly conservative estimate. But the proportions, I think, in any case, will roughly be the same. My perception of what is going on may be one-sided, but I experienced two quite different approaches to the use of energy. One group of people believe and exert tremendous pressure on the government and on our minds by advertising and so-called education in a program with an emphasis on the discovery of new sources of oil, gas, coal, and fissionable materials and new technologies for using them. Reagan, you know, you can just name people, the mobile gases, they're all saying the same thing. They're in the New York Times practically every week. You're being told that what we need is a program which emphasizes the development of the present resources, oil, gas, coal, and fissionable materials. What is needed is more supply of the same. It's what I call the supply approach to the energy issue. Just get more supply, more drilling, more research, more mining, use our oil shale, you know, go into that kind of production. And this group are not able, either because of their self-interest, in the profits of the energy industry and a related industry. And if you begin to get related industry, you have at least half of the industry in this country. Or because of the mindset created by years of thinking in a certain way, they are not capable of understanding and supporting the naturally, I think, desirable movement toward renewable resources. And most federal and state policies have favored the development of this approach to all energy issues. My favorite biomass got about somewhere between 6 and 9. They were debating it, and I don't know what the final results are. 6 and 9 million out of a budget of 1,800 million or something like that, you know, just a pittance for biomass. Solar is getting a little more attention now. Another group of people, mostly individual citizens or small groups of people without much money or power, favor a dramatic change in our policies, with research and development money shifting drastically toward renewable resources and with all kinds of government incentives to entice people and institutions to use renewable sources of energy. Now, this group may be a little blind. I'm in that group. I mean, just clear, I'm in that group. We may be a little blind to the short-term needs of the economic system. But the general push toward long-term dependency on renewable resources and on present policies that aid and abet such development seem to be clearly preferable. I call it moral. Some people object to say it's kind of moralism that you're, but it seems to me it's really immoral not to go in this direction, not to move in this direction with all the difficult decisions and technical problems that are involved. While moral decisions are usually somewhat ambiguous, I'm convinced that there's no real choice for the morally sensitive person but to be on the side of those pushing vigorously for the shift toward renewable resources now, renewable and non-polluting, since it's clear, if you watch your language, that the breeder reactor producing plutonium is, in a way, renewable. So I had to add that phrase, non-polluting. There are many decisions involved in moving in this direction. We'll be discussing some of them. Now, the second thing I want to assert is that we use energy in the wrong way. We not only use the wrong kind of energy, but in using any kind of energy, generally speaking, we use it in the wrong way. Again, if we believe that the resources of the earth are a part of the creation, gifts of God for all life, human and otherwise, we would use resources carefully with a minimum of waste and hence with a maximum of effectiveness or efficiency, whatever term you want to use. Efficiency, I think, probably is the best word. We would get more work for the energy we use. And there's no question in my mind we could get 50-60% more work out of the present energy if we decide it was important enough. The very least we would do is to use energy efficiently. We would build our houses into the sides of hills, face them south, insulate them well, use heat pumps, build cars that use less gasoline, build public transportation systems, arrange work, shopping, and residential areas so that less energy is needed for transportation, recycle almost everything, generate much of our electricity where the heat can be used for heating buildings and industrial processes. Sweden gets 24% more energy than we do. Well, it's maybe about 22.5. 24% heat energy out of their electrical generation because they generate their electricity where they can use the heat. And we push it off into the air or into the streams. And they don't get quite as efficient as much electricity as we do. I think we get about 31, they get 29.5%. So the net result is they get 22.5% more energy out of their, more work out of their energy because they have cogeneration. And we'd encourage efficient industrial technology. All of these are large subjects, but I'm only indicating that if we really believed what we assert in terms of a faithful care for the created goods which have been placed here as gifts for all people, we would use these gifts with great care. That is, if we were thinking of, you know, the year 3000 and the people and whether or not they would have resources. With all the problems, we would encourage pricing policies, which contrary to most present practice, charge more for electricity during the peak load periods daily and seasonally. We would use money incentives, government regulation, and educational programs to encourage patterns of energy use which attain more work from the same amount of energy. In other words, we become much more efficient, and it is possible. Germany is much more efficient than we are. Sweden, most of the fairly industrialized, highly industrialized countries of Europe get more work out of the same amount of energy input. And part of the reason is they haven't had such cheap energy, they haven't had such resources, and so they've developed policies which have encouraged efficient use of energy. The prices of energy have been higher, and so people have learned to use efficient means for getting work. We would also use energy in such a way that we would pollute the air and the water less. Swedish technology, as I've already indicated, discovered a way of burning coal, the fluidized bed process, which virtually eliminates pollution with the exception of the carbon dioxide given off in burning. All kinds of devices that can be used. Cogeneration of electricity I've already talked about. Although the net effect of thermal pollution and of particles or gas in the atmosphere on the heating or cooling of the Earth is up for grabs among the scientists, the resulting interference with natural rhythms and cycles, it seems to me, is sufficiently important to cause us to pause in simply letting things develop as they will. I can't find any way of making up my mind, you know, what's happening to the Earth naturally in terms of heating or cooling cycle, and I don't know exactly the effects of the pollutions of particles, carbon dioxide, in the air, and I don't know the total effect on health. You know, I don't know all of those. But there's sufficiently question being raised that it seems to me it's only sensible to reduce the amount of energy and thereby reduce the amount of energy used and therefore the amount of pollution, unless we're going to use solar energy. Here it seems to me if one recognized inorganic and organic limits or boundaries established in the created order of things, we would not let energy technology develop without trying to take the limits into account. In other words, in developing any technology, we would ask what the long-term consequences are to the very existence of human life. And instead of waiting for the effects to take place, we would ask those questions in the beginning. And of course, the technologists say, well, then we would never develop any technology. And the argument goes round and round. In addition to using energy inefficiently and so as not to pollute, we would use energy in such a way that as technology requires large amounts, we do use it. I got this all mixed up here. In addition to using energy inefficiently and so as to pollute, we would use energy in such a way that as technology requires large, we do use it. So it requires large amounts of capital, concentrated economic and hence political power, and small amounts of manpower. The concentrated energy technology is very, very low in terms of the number of jobs it creates. If you went into conservation programs or what I call efficiency programs and rehabbed and retrofitted or whatever you call that stuff, you get all kinds of increase in the amount of manpower that was required. Here again, we find two quite different approaches to energy and energy use. And everywhere I've discussed this, I find this dichotomy between those who say what we should do is to use energy efficiently and use renewable resources, and those who say we ought to push for more supply. The economy needs the supply, and we just ought to push. And I for the life of me, can't find ways of reconciling those two or getting some of them to listen to each other. But this is the world we live in. I think the group advocating efficient, less polluting use of energy is gaining strength. For example, It doesn't make any sense to increasing number of people to pay out $45 billion a year to import oil, $45 billion a year, and to suffer the economic and political pangs of such payments and the political dependency if we could get 40% more work from our oil and decrease our use thereby, I say, from 6,570 million barrels to 4,693, and I calculated that all out, and our imports, therefore, from 2,900 million barrels to about 1,100 million barrels, the saving of about $27 billion of imports by that increase in efficiency, and the positive effects of this on our balance of payment and on the strength of the dollar is crystal clear. And by a policy of efficient use of gasoline, we could save $27 billion of imports, and the dollar would simply be functioning differently. You could travel abroad without, all kinds of things follow from this. Clearly, it seems to me, it's irresponsible, completely irresponsible, to continue to use oil as inefficiently as we do. It's irresponsible to use energy as inefficiently as we do. And it's also irresponsible to use as much energy as we do when pollution is increased by using more energy than is necessary to get the work done. Well, I've tried to argue that we use our energy in the wrong way, and that therefore this really works toward primarily, although not exclusively, a program which in all kinds of ways encourages the efficient use of energy. So that whatever energy we use, whether we use solar energy or any other kind, the only place I don't worry about efficient use of energy is up at Holden, where that electricity is being generated, they don't know what to do with it, so I don't worry so much here about turning off the lights and doing all the other things, but every other place, it seems to me, it makes no sense to use as much energy and to not work toward more efficient use. Well, I've gone on for quite a while. Let me just indicate a little about my feeling about how we make our energy decisions economically and political in the wrong way. If we believe that the resources of the earth are a part of the creation, gifts of God for all life, human and otherwise, we will use resources so that all life, present and future, has access to needed resources, and so that threats to life from the polluting effects of the use of energy are minimized. You can recognize that fundamental theme. And we would make our economic and political decisions about energy in such a way that such a perspective informed our decisions. That is, I think it's very clear that if you use a market mechanism for affecting decisions, you tend not to get these kinds of perspectives brought into the market. Although you could argue, if the people who are in the market had this kind of a perspective, that those people would influence the market in that way. What is most obvious and indisputable, it seems to me, is that we do not make our economic and political decisions with any such perspective as the dominant one. Some will argue that the way to bring into account the common good is to let the market system function more effectively. That is to say, take off all controls and let the price regulate the system. Now, I am for the reduction of controls. I've advocated a dollar a gallon gasoline tax and such things as that. Now, get into my program the last day, although I have a few copies of it if somebody wants one. What I'm saying here is that in the long run, the market system will not take into account, in my judgment, future generations. So that there has to be some, so that just using the price, taking off regulation, will not solve the problem. And I think a good many economists would agree with me. What the market system has never taken into account are the social costs in pollution. And what you could do, of course, you'd have to use some sort of public policy in order to introduce it, but you could introduce a cost system for pollutions which would be imposed from the outside upon the free market system, but you still wouldn't interfere with the market system. You'd simply make the market system carry the cost, the social cost. You would take the cost of mining, for example, for black lung disease and all those things, borne by the federal government, borne by all of us and not by the industry. Well, if it were borne by the industry, then the price of coal would go up, and then we would use less coal. So that it's not a simple matter, but what I am saying is that we can't depend simply upon the market mechanism for the solution. The market mechanism, in my judgment, has not brought it about. In other countries where the market mechanism is not dependent upon so much, Sweden, for example, although there's a lot of dependence on the market mechanism, the energy efficiency is simply much higher than ours. Well, I go on to talk about this. There are no alternatives, of course, that are very simple, because if you turn it over to the present government, actually the energy policy that has been formulated in this country in the past several decades has been heavily influenced by the federal government, and in such a way that we don't even know what's happening. The decisions were made about nuclear energy by the federal government, and most of us didn't have any information whatsoever. So simply to turn things over to the government as it's been functioning is no solution. I don't have a lot of formulas for solutions. But I conclude that neither our theory nor our practice in the economic and political dimensions of life is morally defensible. As say, we have a system, both of economics and politics, in which there has been no way for the position that I represent to inform. And I've gone to numerous hearings of the government on energy policy, and what happens is that people come and unload all their private prejudices and the government listens, but there's no systematic way. Sweden, for example, had 10,000 discussion groups on energy with 80,000 people participating for a minimum of 10 hours, sponsored by the churches, by the government, by the labor unions. There was an attempt to create a political process which was informed, so that whatever was done in terms of public policy came out of some systematic consideration of the issues by a large enough group of people, so that you couldn't pull the wool down over people's eyes. There were people spread out throughout every community who had been through the process and dealt with the issues. We have nothing like that going on in this country. And so what I'm saying is we're very immoral or irresponsible to, in terms of our economic and political system, for dealing with the energy issue. So it becomes an economic and political issue as in terms of how we're going to deal with it. Now I just want to say one more thing today and take it into political issue, that the energy issue, I think, is a political issue in the sense that the way we organize our energy issue or our energy industry creates a problem for our politics. And this is a moot point, and it's been argued by several people who want to go the renewable energy route, because they claim a decentralized energy route is possible through renewable sources, and it may or may not be. And I've just got a few things here to say about that, and then we'll discuss things. In other words, we have an energy-producing system that requires large investments of capital, concentrations of economic and political power, and technological sophistication, all of which makes it very difficult for ordinary or even extraordinary folk like us, I assume we're all extraordinary folk, to know enough, to know what the policy should be, and to have the means to implement policy if formulated. In other words, the energy technology requires a type of organization that makes meaningful citizenship participation in decision making very, very difficult. To that extent, we use solar energy with a simple technology. We can understand and control our source of energy. Of course, if we develop satellites to collect the sun's rays, which, you know, beam the energy back with laser beam or something, we'll be in no better position than we already are. So it isn't simply a matter of going solar. It's a matter of how we go solar, if you're thinking of this political issue. So perhaps that's enough to get the discussion started. Where we are and what we ought to do. And in the next sessions, I'll talk about energy as a religious issue and then kind of move into some responses.
I think you mentioned that certainly with our existing economic and political system, there's no way that the thing could be resolved as it looks now without some fantastic changes. And that's self-evident. It's just very obvious. In fact, even if we had a grossly changed system so that we could somehow be responsible, would we? I think that it'd have to be international rather than national, because this country consumes, what, a third to a half of the energy used in the world with a very small fraction of the population. So it'd have to be some kind of an international body to see that each country used the amount that it needed, depending on its population and type of industry it had and all. And so that's just an insurmountable problem as it appears, just on a practical
you note. Mean to
certainly I don't think there are many people in the world who feel morally about it the way we do. But the other thing I think is that we cannot draw many analogies between this country and Sweden. We can't do it any more here than we can in the health industry, because our country is so different than Sweden. Sweden's a very small, homogeneous country and well-educated people for the most part. It's just, this country is so much more complicated than Sweden that there's no way one can draw parallels, I don't think. No. So,
well, I don't know why
I
draw parallels.
People
say, well, you know, if there's a direct correlation between the amount of energy we use and the GNP, and you go to Sweden or Germany, you find with less energy use, they have actually, Sweden is higher income per capita than we have. And you can argue, you know, the shortness of the distance. You know, I can go into the details of the argument, some of the stuff I've read, which would indicate what's involved in terms of comparison.
But look at the differences. They probably have a lot more hydroelectric power as a percentage of what they use. They have short distances. They're not an energy-oriented society like we've become, as you mentioned at the outset.
Well, they are. You know, gasoline costs $1.50. They use small cars and all kinds of things. They've gone through what I think we have to go through in terms of developing, and we are moving in that direction. You know, by 1985, our cars have to average in the production quotas of the companies 27.5 miles per gallon. They have to average that. So if you get some of the cars, you know, that means they've really got to push. I don't know whether there'll be a balk and whether they'll rescind that action, but that's public law now.
Look at the other difference. Look at the difference in forms of government between the two countries.
Well, I believe actually we have to move toward their form of government. That is, in other words, we have to move philosophically toward the notion that the polity has to, you know, this gets me into a favorite subject. What we have in this country is a complete fragmentation of our institutions. There's no institution responsible for the common good. We believe somehow if you get the interaction of our major institutions or our interaction of people without any consideration of what the result is, you're going to get the good. So we let the labor unions and the big industry and the big military kind of interact, and we think, called so-called interest group theory of politics, that the good is going to emerge. Now in Sweden, the Lutheran background has never said that is the way to do it. The Lutheran background says you as an individual are responsible for the common life. And it's, you take Minneapolis and Minnesota and you get that same kind of philosophy, and you get some of the best kind of concern for the whole public services, social services, I think it comes out of this sense that we do have that responsibility, that it isn't simply letting the forces interact. Now, if you do that, then you cooperate for the sake of the common good, and that's That's all I say makes the difference. There's more cooperation, more public. See, the notion that they had 10,000 discussion groups was a notion that somehow you had to create a common good and a common mind. And the government thought that was important. Now, we don't think that's important. We just let these forces interact.
Couldn't we do that at our universities, though, and put pressure on the government? All these, you know, we form our groups at universities.
Well, I think we need, I've got a theory about that, but the churches ought to simply take as one of their responsibilities the creation of a public. We don't have publics on any issue. We'd have to have them on energy, we'd have to have them on health and on education and on a whole series of things. And you'd have different publics because different people. You can't attend to all the issues. I simply turn over all the other issues to somebody in my church, and if person I trust kind of, you know, tells me this is what we should do, he should write this letter, I write it. I can't make up my mind about all these things, but if they want to know about energy, then I can tell them.
You know, there's something else you wonder about here too, because you're mentioning the great cultural difference between our country and Sweden now, and of course it's tremendous, but there are other differences. If Sweden had the form of government we had, and if they had a huge energy industry like we do, not only producing petroleum products within the country, but owning oil
all over the world,
abroad, and everything, would they have come to the point that they have?
I don't know. See, that's a real political issue as to how we are going to overcome the forces that. And I've got some stuff in here, I didn't develop it very much. The forces that have such power, I'm told by a guy from one of the joint committees, Senate and the Congress, that when the hearings were being held on the gas issues, that the American Gas Association had $500,000, and they fed all the possible programs and all the arguments for or against them into a computer, and when the committee members walked out of the committee meeting, they got the printouts with their arguments. Now, if you're dealing with that kind of organized economic political power as a citizen, you are really fighting forces that seem impossible. And I have experienced the same kind of thing over and over. No, and what are you going to do to combat it? Well, you cannot let things just happen to combat it. You've got a real problem, it seems to me, in terms of the implementation of anything other than that program of increasing the supply of coal and gas and oil and nuclear. Nuclear industry is organized in that same kind of, you know, group of interests. But that's a political problem. Of tremendous scope.
Now, all of the question about comparing us with Sweden too that gets away from the problem that I think you're talking about this morning in terms of the moral question. As individuals facing the question, as you say, we can't know all the information. I can't sit here and compare our form of government with Sweden's and our energy industry with Sweden's or anything else. But I think, as individuals, all we have to do is look around, just comparing the way we live at home and the way we live at home, the supply of energy being used for natural resources, that a moral decision is necessary for each one of us. What's important? As you said, do we have a responsibility to worry about the year 3000? If we have that responsibility, then facing those political pressures is part of the dilemma, but prior to that dilemma is our own personal dilemma. What do we as individuals have as our responsibility?
Yeah. Of course, we have a personal responsibility, right, in terms of what we can do individually, buying small cars and so on. Great debate when we got our Toyota, on which with Paul it is impossible almost. But we made it all the way from Chicago with all the stuff. And the second one is that we have a responsibility for the political and economic decisions,
personal
too.
Personal responsibility.
Yeah, personal responsibility, right. Yeah. Well, I only use Sweden. I think you're right to illustrate that that energy can be used more efficiently. Now, how we get it used more efficiently,
we wouldn't do it the same as Sweden.
Is a great issue. I mean, it's impossible, of course, to conceive of Congress being able to withstand the onslaught of the public if you imposed a tax on gasoline of $1 a gas, you know, a gallon. I mean, it is completely impossible politically with our system. I don't know how you'd get a system.
What system would he have?
I don't know. It's clear that some systems can do that.
I cringe every time I hear you mention the Swedish system as being ideal.
I didn't say it was ideal.
I would think that I should have.
I just said that there were some things about it which led to more efficient use of energy and more intelligent public policy with regard to energy.
Another issue, I think, moral issue, is the that we have to come to terms with the fact we must share the energy with the rest of the world, particularly the developing countries who can't afford to grow energy, like you say, grow the plants that produce the alcohol and such. And we, it's behooving that we find a solution to these kinds of things. Yeah. For instance, one proposal could be for the problem of a plant giving off more CO2 than it absorbs to turn into oxygen. And of course, the problem then is probably the how much of the square surface of our nation is in green that can absorb carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. And the areas that use the most produce the most CO2, but produce the least oxygen is the cities. Isn't that right? That's the polluting area, really, the major one. Why can't we make something mandatory, for instance, in terms of green in cities? Each building. It could be mandatory for each building in the city to have green plants that will be green the year round, somewhere on that building that's in equivalent to the square foot of that building. For instance, ivy could be grown on top without much weight, without effort, without really any. And streets could have green belts, trees, or parks, or something of that nature. But I think we have another way we have to start thinking about this issue rather than coming up with, well, look, we can't do this because of the harm it does. How do we solve that harm and then get away from us digging our energy? Let's use our oil, let's use our coal to produce fertilizer or something for those people. You know, I mean, this kind of sharing, I think, is really a moral issue that we don't deal with quite as much as we should yet.
Yeah, it's interesting in this seminar in New Mexico at Ghost Ranch. We had a technician from Dow Corning, and he was developing a program which he had to finish in 2 weeks for the Egyptian government, where they are providing the technology to turn the desert into livable land through solar energy. The solar would provide cooling and pump the water. Solar energy. And what we were doing, I once said the best missionary effort we could do is to develop solar and give it, the solar technology, and give it to the world. And we raise real questions, you know, how much control are they going to have over that solar technology which they've spent the money to develop, and therefore the Egyptians are going to have to pay a high price for. And that's where the mission comes in. You could develop the technology and give it away, in a sense, so that I really think that's probably one of the best things we could do. Many areas where they have so much sun is to develop the solar technology for them and give it. It's so clear that solar technology is a non-polluting way, and that there's just all kinds of things that can be done with it. It may take a little money and not be efficient now, and the market, of course, won't get into it if it's less efficient. For example, we're trying to do that in a building which we're trying to rehab as a part of our church community, and put a greenhouse in and so forth. The problem is the expense right now, but we would have a greenhouse to grow all the food we needed for all the people in the community built into the rehab program. Certainly we'll have a greenhouse on top. The question is where you can put it on the side because of the solar window with the buildings next door. You know, all kinds of problems, but no question about it. You could have the kind of thing you were talking about on rooftops and all over, and all the rehab that ought to be done if the government would put its money into rehabbing instead of letting the buildings deteriorate and turn down. And you could build them with this stuff built in. And you could, you know.
That seems to me to be much more creative.
Oh, we are just excited about it.
More than way, than always thinking of digging out this energy and taking more of it, because that's what you're dealing with in the first place. And using it.
I hate to be a cynic, but I still think it's going to take something like this removal of controls or economic incentive, but the price get high enough to make people suddenly realize that energy is not an endless, currently used types are not endless. But this recent economic conference that occurred within the past 4 to 6 weeks that Carter went to with demands that Japan import more of our things and West Germany import more of our things. Goodness gracious, our trade imbalance is horrible. And they turned around and the French said to him, along with several others, not emphatically, you guys in the United States don't blame us for your trade imbalance, it's all this oil you're buying. And we want to ask you now, or urge you strongly, to start being more responsible about your energy use. This was not Sweden, this was France and some of the others.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it'll take that kind of outside pressure to say to the government of the United States, let's encourage or subsidize.
Of course, it's not the government. I mean, we, in a sense, are the government. And we haven't demanded it. There will be no significant energy program come out of Congress. It'll be so batched, you know, and cut up that there'll be really nothing really significant. And why won't it come out of Congress? Why will Congress not do it? Is it because the energy industry has the purse strings on our congressmen? Because they've got the resources to buy them out? Or is it because we as constituents don't really believe in an adequate energy program?
Republican difference, isn't it?
Beg pardon?
It's too low on our list of priorities. The voters. Too low.
We're always a public and something else. We're a public and a member of a labor union, or a public and a stockholder. And when it comes down to crunch, it's that one special interest in that case maybe that we give our allegiance to rather than the general public that we are a part of.
I think we as individuals in our country have lost the faith in the sense that we don't believe anymore that we are the power, so we don't exert it anymore. But when it comes down to any issue, the politicians are only going to vote for the way the constituents put the pressure on them. And you don't have to do it by lobbies, we can do it by our needs. And this, I think it's very feasible, but it takes an awful lot of effort, a lot of mobilizing of our forces of individuals. But we are even now, we're a country where the individuals, if they let the our representatives know what we want, they will change their mind and do what we want them to do. It happens over and over again. We're finding it even happening now in the energy situation. I think I can see, or at least I hope I'm seeing this, that they're being very hesitant as to which way to go on energy. A lot of it might be some of the pressure from the energy source, but they really aren't sure what their constituents want. Yeah, I don't think we've made our point clear, and once we do, they may change their views considerably. And I think what we need is a lot of confidence that we're the boss, then maybe we can do something, not the idea that we're nothing anymore, that the big powers are the only ones that have influence. I don't believe that. Not yet.
And practically, though, if we were to try to implement our being the boss, I would think we would need, let's see, I was estimating maybe 100 groups in each state. 5,000, that'd be, wouldn't it? 5,000 to 6,000 public forum types of things where there's a continuous responsibility where you met every 2 or 3 months in for a whole day and really worked on the development of the program, because you've got to get the program, you have the policy and the implementation, and so the operation, and
you can't talk from emotion, you have to have something.
This sounds like a tremendous expenditure of energy out.
Oh, it is. That's right. Tremendous expenditure of human energy. But you know, when you get excited about something like having a new son, you get new energy.
Yeah.
And this, is if you really got excited about some issue like this, I find I you know, if it looks like it's worth doing, you find all kinds of resources of energy you never thought you had, because it's meaningful.
Well, that reminded me of a proposal that got nowhere. It got into Congress. I think it was just a congressman proposal, but that was the end of it. That the areas, the energy-producing areas of the country, that we all pay the same amount for our energy. We have very cheap energy here in the Northwest, so we would add maybe another $40, $50, $60 a year to our bill in order to lower the bill the rest of the country and share it equally. And as I recall at the time, that this didn't get anywhere. People from this area and areas where there's cheap work, they weren't about to share that by reason
or water.
Kind of course, those are ideas that have come up.
That's a real matter of our faith.
Yes. How much are you willing to share so other people can have?
I think probably we ought to adjourn so you can get up there and get in the line and share the food.
You're welcome.